Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Today we're talking with Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen, but we're going to take a step away from day-to-day politics. Chris Bowen has written a book titled The Money Men, which looks at a dozen of Australia's most notable treasurers. It's an impressive history from a man who was, albeit briefly, treasurer himself and hopes to be again. Chris Bowen, I don't think you've had much slack time in the last few years. How did you manage to get in all this research?
Well, Michelle, as you said, it was quite a project for me, but one I enjoyed very much. And I guess I managed to make the time a couple of ways. Firstly, I've always read for pleasure, but for the last 2 years, I haven't done much reading for pleasure, hardly any. I've written for pleasure in my spare time. Some late nights, there comes a time in an evening when, you know, I often do my work at home and have my briefing notes around me, but there comes a time when you just can't take in much more of a briefing note or briefing notes from your office, and you put them aside and pull out some research on a treasurer long past, or do some writing, and also long plane trips. You know, I do spend a fair bit of time in the air, and the plane is an office, and again, sometimes at the beginning of a trip I might start on shadow treasurer business, but towards the end I might put that aside and get out some research or get out the laptop and do some typing. So for 2 years or 18 months or so, that's been what I've doing. Now, the book had been in my mind for some time. It had been floating around in my mind as a concept, and, you know, I've always read about treasurer's past, so it wasn't a completely blank canvas, but obviously writing intensively for 2 years was how the project came about.
Now, you interviewed some recent treasurers, including Peter Costello and John Howard. Were they at all reluctant or suspicious when you approached them?
Well, I don't know, but they both agreed, for which I'm very grateful. And they were both very generous with their time. And I wasn't sure how they would respond when I asked full time. I explained the project. And they both agreed very quickly. And they were both more than happy to talk. John Howard in particular, I must say, when I put to him some criticisms of his time as treasurer and some observations, was not defensive at all and was, if you like, agreeable to some of them. He acknowledged, that was a long time ago for him, obviously, but he nevertheless was very open and honest about his tenure as treasurer and its successes and failures.
And, of course, he's written the odd bit of history himself.
Like he has. So he understood what I was trying to achieve, I think. Mm.
Nevertheless, is it hard to be non-partisan, objective in this sort of project when, of course, most of the time you're being partisan?
Well, you do have to work hard at it, yes, to make sure you're being as objective as you can be. Now, I reach conclusions in the book. I make arguments, and
you evaluate every character,
and I evaluate every one of the 12 who made the book, and I do that, as you said, as a partisan, but I also do it as objectively and fairly, and, you know, as an historian, if I can put it that way. I try to be, and, you know, I'm very proud of Labor's legacy in economic management over the years, but it would be churlish to say we always got everything right, and there's some criticisms of my own party in there historically, and I pay tribute to some of the treasurers from the other side, and I don't think it would be a serious book if I didn't do that. Now, other people have different perspectives. I've got no doubt that Peter Costello would say I haven't been as complimentary to his time as treasurer as I should have been from his point of view, but I do pay compliment to him on a number of measures, but I just reach the conclusions that I do, and I try to do so objectively and fairly.
We'll come to him in a minute, but you've been a treasurer. Does that experience bring something special to your approach to this topic in your role as historian?
I think so. I was only treasurer briefly, far too briefly for my liking, but having done it, having brought down an economic statement, run an election campaign as treasurer, I do think it brings you a perspective. I did contemplate briefly calling the book A Treasurer on Treasurers, in the tradition of Harold Wilson's A Prime Minister on Prime Ministers, but I decided that it'd be a bit arrogant given I was only treasurer briefly, and the term money men came to mind instead. But yes, I do think it brings a perspective which somebody else might not have if they were writing a similar book.
Now, going back to Peter Costello, it has been rather fashionable to play down his achievements as treasurer, I guess, to see him presiding over easy times. What's your take on him?
Well, again, trying to be objective and fair, he was a long-serving treasurer. He brought down many budgets. He was completely on top of the task. He was on top of the detail. He did bring the GST in. Now, the GST, regardless of what its merits are, was a heinously complex task, and he knew as much about it as any living Australian, and it could have all gone very wrong for him and his government if he'd not been on top of the detail. So he clearly had the grasp to do that. I find that his reform credentials don't stack up to, say, Paul Keating's, even though he was in office for longer than Paul Keating. Paul Keating was much more aggressive and successful reformer, economic reformer, than Costello. Costello had the GST and budget surpluses.
Mind you, of course, in Costello's defence, a lot of that work had already been done by the time he arrived.
Sure, but reform is a never-ending process. I'm very complimentary of Costello's actions during the Asian financial crisis, most primarily in international relations. By the time the Asian financial crisis came around, the dollar had been floated, and there were lots of automatic shock absorbers in the system. However, it was nevertheless a very fraught time, and Costello worked out that the United States was getting it wrong, and the IMF was getting it wrong. And he had very good advice from the Reserve Bank in particular, but he listened to that advice, and he took it up, and he was convinced by it, and he convinced John Howard and Alexander Downer. And he argued with the Americans and the IMF that they were too harsh on Indonesia in some senses, and they had the wrong prescription for Indonesia. Now, if Indonesia wasn't well handled, it had massive implications for Australia and the world. And Costello was right, and the Clinton administration was wrong, and the IMF was wrong. And I think history has validated Costello's approach there. Now, on the surpluses, I mean, I do make the point that the terms of trade and the increase in government revenue was extraordinary. It was almost impossible not to bring down a surplus. And Costello himself, in his memoirs, writes about how he'd bring down a budget, and within a week, the Treasury would be back with revised forecasts, but they'd all be on the up, not on the down, which his successors have experienced. He had everything was on the up.
Money tree.
Yeah. So, you know, yes, there were difficult decisions he had to make, particularly in the early period of his government, but the surplus, I think almost anybody who was treasurer during that time would have brought down surpluses.
Now, you rate Paul Keating as the best of your bunch of notable treasurers. Do you think that there's a bit of a tendency, however, to romanticise Keating at all? And you know Keating very well. Mm. You're quite close to Keating. Were you under any pressure?
No, I wasn't under any pressure.
Self-imposed or externally imposed?
He's a friend of mine, but I objectively think his record as treasurer entitles him to be regarded as the best in history. It's not a hagiography. I mean, there's criticism in there of Paul. I mean, the recession was clearly something which was the result of decisions.
Except you do say that on a number of occasions he got things right.
Correct.
And the institutions
Correct.
Were wrong.
You've got to look, and I did look at this very, very closely to make sure I was getting it right. Keating was making, in many senses, the right calls. He was arguing with the Reserve Bank, who at various points in the cycle were tightening or loosening interest rates when Keating thought it should be going the opposite way. And hindsight tells us Keating was right. But it's not a hagiography. I don't give him a complete blank check, but I do conclude that he was, in my view, the best treasurer in our history, mainly for that economic reform and his zeal and his willingness to go out and argue and win the argument. And he put his considerable command of the English language in his own fashion to work to argue for economic reform. And in that regard, I think objectively he comes out on top. I just certainly didn't feel any pressure from him to do so, but I was hard on myself to make sure I got it right.
And just in relation to how much was Keating, how much was Hawke, I noticed when you talk about the float, for example, you perhaps give Keating more initiating credit than some others would give him, because some saw Hawke as stronger than Keating on that matter.
Well, this is one of the arguments of history, And there's those who argue it was Bob Hawke driving the float and those who argue it was Paul Keating. I looked at it very closely and tried to start with the blank canvas. And I don't accept that Paul Keating was dragged kicking and screaming to the float, which is some people's narrative. That is just not true. What I do completely accept is that Bob Hawke wanted to do it as well, and that it wouldn't have happened if he didn't want to. And he gave Keating the opportunity to do it, and he was convinced of its merits. The evidence that Keating wanted to float the dollar is, I think, substantial from quite a bit earlier than when he did it. There were meetings with the Treasury Secretary, with the senior officials at Treasury, where he was arguing for it, and Treasury was disagreeing with him, and he didn't feel, and it seems difficult to imagine this now, knowing what we know about Paul, but he didn't feel at the time he was strong enough to overrule the Treasury. He was a new Treasurer, he was a fairly young one, he was still 39, John Stone was a colossus of the Treasury. He'd been Secretary since 1979, from memory. And, he was a very formidable figure, and he didn't feel he had the ability to overrule John Stone. Eventually, he did, but it took him some time to convince himself that he was able to do it. And, of course, there was a currency crisis. And the other unsung hero, there are two unsung heroes, if you like, of that process, briefly. Bob Johnson, the governor of the Reserve Bank. Howard, in fairness to him, had wanted to float the dollar as well, but he had neither the Secretary of the Treasury or the Governor of the Reserve Bank on board. It was Keating needed one of them, Howard had none. And the other is Ted Evans, quietly spoken, former electrical engineer, who went on later to become Secretary of the Treasury, but it was that stage a senior official. And there was a meeting in Old Parliament House where Keating was arguing with Stone, and he was getting frustrated. And he said to the senior officials present, "Doesn't anybody here agree with me that the dollar should be floated?" And Ted Evans very softly spoke and said, "I support your Treasurer," which showed enormous courage on Ted Evans' behalf.
You're fairly soft on Wayne Swan. Is it difficult to write about someone that you've been working with and someone who's still around in the same parliament?
Well, I was conscious, of course, that, as this discussion has shown, that almost all the focus would be on the most recent treasurers and what I write about them. I mean, there are some fascinating stories amongst the earlier treasurers, which perhaps I can mention along the way. Some of the earlier treasurers have just amazing stories. But on Wayne Swan, look, again, I try to be fair. I think objectively his response to the global financial crisis, working closely with Kevin Rudd, does deserve praise. There are other areas, I write what I write about the minerals resource rent tax, for example, and the process there and how that, there are lessons to be learnt out of that. I try to be fair and objective, but I think the sort of any fair analysis shows that Australia was almost inevitably heading to recession. There are very, very few treasurers, if any, other treasurers who can say a recession looked inevitable and I avoided one. Swan is almost unique, if not unique, in that category.
Now, we'll work back to some of those earlier treasurers. Mm. Jim Cairns, one of the most charismatic figures of his generation, and yet a disaster as treasurer. You point out how qualified he was in formal terms with his economic history background. How did that disaster happen?
Well, some people have questioned why I included Jim Cairns, and I point out the subtitle of the book is not Australia's 12 Best Treasurers, it's Australia's 12 Most Notable.
He was certainly notable.
He was certainly notable, whether it's the scandals and the intrigue and, frankly, the sex and the all the colour and light that went with that, or the loans affair, or just that tumultuous six-month period. But even more important than that is, as you refer to, the lessons to be learnt from his treasurership. He was, on paper, our most academically prepared, a doctor of philosophy in economic history, bachelor's degrees and master's degrees in commerce, written multitudinous books and pamphlets, but singularly unsuited to be treasurer. And I thought, well, how did this come about? And really it comes down to, in a nutshell, judgment. He was fiercely intelligent and lacked judgment. And his economic theories were not credible. He did not work well with the Treasury. He did not take advice well. He was headstrong. And simply, he didn't understand economics. He was an economic historian, but not an economist. Compare and contrast with Bill Hayden, his successor, who was a superb treasurer, who queried the Treasury, held their ideas up to the light, questioned them, and then when he was convinced, went in, argued it in the Cabinet, won, self-taught economist, got his economics degree, working late nights in the parliamentary library as a backbencher, and had the judgment to go with it. Now, the story, I think, which is most telling about Cairns as to why he was a failure, and I just found this just remarkable, was he was in the, down at the lodge over the road one evening for a national executive meeting in the ALP. He got a bit bored and he wandered off and he walked into the Prime Minister's dining room, a room I know well, and there was Gough and Lionel Murphy and Rex Connor and Sir Lennox Hewitt, and they were having an executive council meeting. And the Treasurer, Jim Cairns, says, "What's going on here then?" And Gough says, "Well, we're borrowing some money. We're authorising the borrowing of money." It's the first the Treasurer heard of it. And Jim Cairns nods and says, "Oh, okay then," and wanders off. Now, I can't think of any other Treasurer who would be told by the Prime Minister that there was a major decision like that occurring, which he had no knowledge of. It really just went to dysfunction and the lack of judgment. Anybody else, any other Treasurer would have said, "Well, no, you're not. Not until I'm happy and satisfied that all the necessary matters are in place."
In a way, he was a sort of innocent in in many areas, wasn't he, including how to operate in government properly.
Yes, and of course, I mean, Whitlam, who we all love and revere in my party, has to take some responsibility for appointing him in the first place, because he had Cairns had undermined Crean, who I don't write about in the book in any detail, but he'd undermined Crean as Treasurer and basically vetoed his budget strategy, etc. And then Gough had said, "Well, if you want to be Treasurer, you might as well be Treasurer. If you're going to undermine the other bloke, I'm going to give you the job." It wasn't out of any great confidence that he'd be a good Treasurer. And that's not really a good way to...
He had quite a lot of support in the party, though, by that stage.
He did, he did. And, of course, they'd run against each other for the leadership. So there was all sorts of tensions and disputes between them. And then he'd defeated Lance Barnard as deputy leader after the 1974 election. So all that was true, but he still shouldn't have been Treasurer. And in I suppose in Cairns' defence, he didn't really want to be. I mean, he'd argued with Whitlam that he didn't want to be Treasurer. Maybe deep down he knew that he wouldn't be very good at it.
Take us back to some of the earlier people that perhaps are surprises in the book. Mm. Earl Page, for example.
Well, Earl Page, obviously I'd always heard of Earl Page and knew his history as a short-serving Prime Minister and one of the founders of the Country Party, and, of course, the famous disputes between him and Menzies. But I actually found him to be a good Treasurer, and perhaps surprised me a little on the upside as to how good he was. And one of the key themes in the book is the relationship between prime ministers and treasurers, and ones that have worked and ones that haven't. And he's a key example of one that has. He was the first coalition treasurer, formally, the first Country Party treasurer, the first time the Country Party and then Nationalist Party had been in coalition together. And it was an experiment, which may well have failed. But if you look at the contours of coalition governments to this day, including this one, many of them were set by Page. He set the precedents and the traditions as to how it would all work. Now, of course, the Country Party or the National Party no longer claims the Treasury portfolio, but they do claim the Deputy Prime Ministership, which in those days was effectively the same thing. And he worked very closely with Bruce, his Prime Minister. They had an excellent partnership. And really, those two were the glue that held the government together, which is what a Prime Minister and Treasurer need to do. Some other early notable Treasurers, if you like, Michelle, Ted Theodore, who comes out very, very well, I think. History should judge him very kindly. He was Treasurer during the Depression, became Treasurer 2 days before the Wall Street crash of 1929. A remarkable baptism of fire. And he basically knew what to do. He basically knew the answer to the Depression. I'm not saying he would have fixed everything, but if he'd been allowed to put his policies into place, the impact on Australia of the Great Depression would have been very significantly ameliorated. He knew that the fiscal stimulus was required. And he actually, this is fascinating, he actually introduced a bill before the House called the Fiduciary Notes Bill. If you look at what that bill was designed to do, it was basically quantitative easing, which has happened, around the world for the last couple of years in response to a similar crisis, a less severe crisis. But Theodore identified that there was a shortage of money. He brought down the Fiduciary Notes Bill. It was defeated in the Senate. And some conservatives, protesters, infiltrated the gallery of the House of Representatives and threw down fake money as he was introducing the bill, monopoly money or its equivalent predecessor. Because this was just a few years after the Weimar Germany inflation outbreak and it was seen as heresy, but he was 100% right. And it was a terrible, terrible time for the Labor Party. The Labor Party was split in several directions. We had Lang, we had the Conservatives, Lyons and Fenton. We didn't have the majority in the Senate. And the Commonwealth Bank, which was then the central bank, played an appalling role. Most particularly its chairman played an appalling role in stymieing Treasurer and doing from what the Treasurer felt he needed to do. So Theodore is a fascinating story. And perhaps just finally, William Watt, a man who's been lost to history. Not many people would be able to identify him in a lineup. He was one of Billy Hughes' six treasurers. He was a fastidious, intelligent man. He's a former Premier of Victoria. He became Treasurer and he clashed repeatedly with Hughes, who was complete opposite in temperament and governing style. And Hughes took himself off to Versailles to negotiate the peace in World War One, and Watt was left in charge.
And of course, they went away for a very long time in those days.
17 months. 17 months he was gone, and Watt was acting Prime Minister for the
whole
time.
I wonder what the
entitlements were. That's right. And, of course, it's very clear, judging history, that they hadn't had a discussion about who was going to decide what. And they had this dispute across the world between Melbourne, which was acting as the capital, and London or Versailles, wherever Hughes was at that particular time. And the cables, just 100 years later, I reproduce quite a few of them in the book, and I just find them fascinating reading, the way they were talking to each other and the building. You can see the tension building and building and building. I won't spoil the story for those who haven't read it yet, but it ends spectacularly. The biggest bust-up of a Treasurer and Prime Minister in Australian history.
It's a fascinating relationship, that, isn't it? Mm. Because it can be very close, or it can be tension-filled, or it can be close and then end up full of tension.
Mm. And you're dealing with two people who, by almost definition, headstrong, ambitious, smart. They would have got this far if they weren't, and they've got to find an accommodation to work. And sometimes they've both sought the prime ministership, sometimes, not every time.
And sometimes they still want it.
And sometimes they still want it. Sometimes there's an ambition to succeed the prime minister. And all of those things can work. I mean, the key is an understanding of the various roles and supporting each other. So if you look at the best practice, the best case scenarios, it's Page and Bruce, Curtin and Chifley, Keating and Hawke, and Costello and Howard. Now, all of them were very, very different relationships, but they all worked in their own way.
Do you think that the Treasury is a good training ground, as it were, or a preparation ground for the Prime Ministership?
Oh, it certainly can be, yes, absolutely. Now, to my way of thinking, there's sort of three types of Treasurer. There's those who use it as a staging ground to become Prime Minister. There's those who've been ambitious for that role themselves, and that's their peak of their ambition and the pinnacle. And there's those who never really sought it, but they sort of falls in their lap. They would have been happy doing any number of portfolios as senior ministers and never being treasurer. I thought about this, and I actually spoke to John Howard about it, whether which type of the treasurer you are determines how well you succeed. I don't think you do. I think you just get in the job and you do your best at it, regardless of how you see the role.
The relationship with Treasury can be very different, can't it? Mm. John Howard came in a bit innocent in economics. Mm. He dried out economically under Treasury's tutelage. Jim Cairns obviously had a very bad relationship with Treasury. Mm. Do you think that relationship depends on the personalities or the economics of the incumbent Treasurer or the personality of the head of Treasury? Or?
All of the above, I think. Obviously, the Treasury are first-class officials. Now, they obviously come at the task with a sort of market orientation, and it would helps if the Treasurer understands that and is sympathetic to a market orientation, believing in the power of the market to do good, not unfettered markets, not unregulated markets, and government intervention is important. But that's where Cairns went wrong, because he didn't really fundamentally believe in that. But all the above, you've got to have a Treasurer, I think, who tests the Treasury, who argues with them internally, who queries their advice, who tells them to go back and do more work. You can't be a cipher for the Treasury. But when you're convinced, you've got to go into the Cabinet confident that you can win. I argue in the book, a Treasurer does not need to win every argument within the Cabinet, but they need to win most, the vast majority. Keating didn't win every. There were two spectacular ones he lost, but he won basically everything else.
And he had a few hissy fits when he didn't.
And occasionally he had to storm out of the cabinet room. And, you know, you look back on the Hawke Keating era now and you think it was all smooth and they knew exactly what to do. And as you well know, Michelle, who reported on it very intensively, that's not the case. They were fighting their way like every other government, but they got it right in the vast majority of cases.
Now, this is a bit of a free kick for you in your current role, but let's think of the third or fourth edition of this book. Do you think you might be able to squeeze Joe Hockey in, or do you think he will never get into the notables?
Oh, well, I'm really trying to be fair about this, Michelle. I've tried not to make it.
Historian's hat?
My historian's hat. Well, there are a few treasurers who I could have written about who I didn't, simply for space reasons. John Dawkins, unfortunately, I would have liked to have written about him, but because I think he was a substantial figure. Richard Casey, perhaps. Harold Holt, maybe. I think I'd be writing about them before I got to Joe Hockey.
So the most notable 20, perhaps.
Something like that.
And just finally, out of the things from your research, what do you think you've learnt that would bring you to the job more qualified second time round?
Well, I think those key lessons. One, a Prime Minister and Treasurer need to understand each other. And, you know, the Prime Minister and Treasurer really need to have a talk before they're even in their offices about, well, how's this going to work? You know, we're going to work well together. I'm going to push the envelope for reform. You've got to let me, basically. That's a key. Secondly, the relationship with the Treasury, which has got to be very, very strong, mutual respect. It wasn't the case with Cairns. It wasn't the case with Howard for part of it. Stone and Howard fell out spectacularly at the end of Howard's time as Treasurer. And an ability to push the envelope. The Treasurer's role is to push the envelope for reform internally and externally, argue for tough decisions within the government. But the government's got to have the confidence in turn that the Treasurer can go out and win the arguments publicly. There's a sort of a compact there. The Treasurer needs to convince the government that they can, and the government needs to be satisfied that they will win the arguments.
Chris Bowen, I'm sure you've sent an autographed copy of this book to Bill Shorten. Thank you very much for talking with us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Thanks for your time.
Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back again with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.